Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
On this autumnal morning, I'm going to welcome somebody who hasn't been on for a while. John Endres, my boss and the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations. And John, firstly, welcome. And secondly, I'm going to ask you, why are we even going to talk about the issue? And the issue is growth. John, the IRR has made the sort of cornerstone of fundamental theme of the next couple of years to talk about growth, because it is so fundamental to any change to the good that the society needs in order to climb out of the morass it is in. Why such an emphasis on growth? Economists talk about growth. Politicians talk about growth, or they talk about growth and they refuse to actually do anything about growth. Surely, I mean, most thinking people will think growth is a good thing. Isn't that the beginning and end of it? Clearly, it's not as simple as that.
Well, Sarah, it's great to be back on the show. Thank you for having me back on. And there's actually quite a number of ways in which you can approach this. And I think maybe a useful one to start off with today would be by referring to a book called The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth by Benjamin Friedman, where Professor Friedman, at its most basic, makes the argument that there are two ways in which people think about whether they are happy with their lives or not. The first way is that they look across the street to their neighbor's parking lot and they see a Porsche and they compare themselves to the neighbor and they say, he's better off than me and I feel miserable as a result. That's the one way how we figure out if we're happy or not. The other way is that we look to the past and we compare ourselves to the way we used to be. And we might go back 5 years and say, 5 years ago, I was earning, for argument's sake, 10,000 rand. Today, I'm earning 15,000 rand. I'm actually quite happy with that. I'm, you know, happy with the way things are going. And if I look to the future, maybe 5 years from now, I'll be at 20,000 rand. And so I feel good about the way things are going. And this ultimately is a really strong argument for economic growth, because what it does is that it allows people to see progress within their own lives and see the tangible benefits of greater wealth in their own lives. And of course, also the choice that greater wealth gives you in your life. If you're really poor, your options are limited. You know, you haven't got a choice of healthcare, of schooling, of police, of maybe where you live. You know, you're quite limited in your choice. And if you have more wealth, you've got more choice. That, I think, is also something that the EFF correctly identified. You know, there's not that much that we agree with them on, but they're right about this. You know, economic freedom, in their interpretation, it means if you have resources, if you have a bit of money set aside, then you've got things that you can do. You can choose what to do with your life. And having that choice is really, really important. So that is why you want economic growth.
We're in that extraordinary situation where I think I can probably comfortably speak on behalf of South Africa in this regard. And that is that people are generally very frustrated, poorer. The options are closing, such as they are. We have one of the worst, if not the worst, unemployment rates in the world. It didn't happen yesterday. It's over a number of years. And there's one thing that repeated IRR polling has shown is that if there is one thing that is always at the top of the list of people's concerns about their lives, it's unemployment. And that encapsulates to some extent what you're saying, is that employment is not just about earning money to put on the table. It is implies so much more than that. And yet our president and the ANC in general somehow takes the fact that there are over 28 million odd people dependent in the broader sense on some branch or grants as an achievement. And while it might be seen as some perverse achievement in terms of ANC ideology, I think it's got to be one of the biggest tragedies that this should be seen as an achievement, because the sort of social grants we're paying cannot possibly go towards anything other than survival.
Yeah, and there's a certain ambiguity in the social grants, and it is one that we also discuss at work quite a lot, which is that they do help to keep the wolf from the door. You know, if you don't have a job and you've got no income, maybe you don't have family that supports you, at least this helps you to keep your head above water. And I think in that sense, social grants are really important. And so we don't advocate for taking them away. But as you point out, the reason that, or the fact that they should be necessary in the first place is where the tragedy lies. Because as you said, it's about 28 million people in a population of 60 million who are receiving some form of direct financial support from the state, which is an extraordinary number, considering that there's only about 16 million people with jobs, and there's only about 7 million people who pay personal income tax. So the proportions are completely lopsided. And here again, this is a question of growth. And ultimately, you know, whatever the ills in South Africa we discuss, we'll find out that it can be drawn back to lacking economic growth over the past decade and a half. We did some calculations to see what it would take to bring South Africa's unemployment rate down into the single digits. And effectively what it will take is about 7% GDP growth per annum for 10 years. If you do that, if you grow for 7% for 10 years, you double the size of the economy. And according to our modeling, you'd bring down the unemployment rate to 9.9%. So you'd sort of just get it down into the single digits. And that plainly should be one of the objectives of public policy. But it's not at all what we're seeing from the government. And that is something I find quite shocking, which is the sort of the resignation that we seem to sense from the government about accepting the current status quo, where there's such a pressing need to do something about it. But instead, the government seems to have resigned itself to administrating the situation as it is, managing the misery as best it can, rather than thinking about a way of changing the situation fundamentally. And as far as we're concerned, there really is only one way to achieve this change, and that has got to be through rapid economic growth. We think that some people in the government do realize it, certainly in the Treasury. If we read the budget reports, we can see that the Treasury is aware of the complexity of the situation, of the need for economic growth, which of course also impacts their core competence, which is the public finances. We're running deficits. We have a big debt mountain that we have to service as a country. And there really is not a proper way of getting out of that situation again without fast economic growth. So that is what we need to be aiming at as a country.
It's not my strong suit, but I think I'd probably be correct in saying that the more people, individuals, and the more companies that South Africa would have who can pay tax, the greater the government's coffers would fill and be available to provide the support needed, A, to those who can't, are being left behind or cannot get onto quite that mainstream on the one hand, and on the other hand, provide all the things that a government should provide to make everybody's life automatically easier and incentivize their participation. And it's that sort of circle of if you do the one, you'll get the other, and if you do the other, the more of the one will come, and so on and so forth. Before we look at what we need specifically to do, first question is, are we looking at a government that, short of losing power, it will not open up to the private sector in the way that this country needs it to do?
Yeah, that pretty much seems to be the case. So I know that the IRR, before my time, try to argue with the ANC very much out of self-interest, from the point of view of the ANC, saying, look at the election results, dear ANC. Whenever the economy is growing and people are doing better in their lives, your support goes up. And in 2004, the ANC achieved almost 70% support from the electorate, and deservedly so. But then when the economy does badly, then support for the ANC drops. And what more argument do you need to create economic growth that will provide jobs, make people better off, and also help you as a political party to build your support? But that message doesn't seem to be landing at all. And it seems that the ANC really is very much stuck in its ways, and it can't consider an approach that would generate fast economic growth.
Nothing wrong with a little enlightened self-interest. The other thing is that we've discussed with colleagues the fact that there's an element to the extent to which those who would support growth and who are part of making growth happen, business, big or small, etc., don't necessarily understand the political or appreciate the political necessity for growth.
Yes, and it's in a way understandable, because growth is sort of an abstract thing. right? So you can't eat growth, you can't touch it, you can't see it with your eyes. What is growth exactly? And I think ordinary citizens have more justification for not knowing about the relationship between growth and their personal situation. And business has less of an excuse because they really should know that in an economy that's growing, their opportunities multiply. But nonetheless, this is the public education task that we've set ourselves to explain exactly what the impact is of growth. And I'll maybe draw on our conversation from a few days ago where we spoke about the topic of dignity.
Mm.
And we said, look, you know, what ultimately is it that you're trying to achieve? And ultimately, it really is about people's dignity. And the situation we have currently, I think, infringes on people's dignity in so many different ways. If you think of people in the townships having to walk through rivers of sewage to get to their houses, there's no dignity in that. Or if you think of people having to queue from the early hours of the morning once a month to get their small grant from the state and being sprayed from water cannons if the wrong minister is around at the wrong time. Right. Or if you think of the indignity of not having a job, not having an income, not being able to support your family, or if you're a young person wanting to start a family, not really having the means to do so, because you know that you will not be able to support your partner or any children you might have, and therefore you stay out of the marriage market if you're being responsible.
Mm.
And that's also an indignity. You know, you should be able to have a marriage or a partnership with somebody that you love and be able to build up a life together. But to do that, you do need to have the economic resources, and those economic resources have to come from an economy that is growing because it is generating value for the people in the economy. And I think that dignity argument maybe makes it a bit more tangible than just talking about the very technical phenomenon of economic growth.
Can I also suggest, just because it may have some resonance with our audience, is that even the comfortable middle classes, relatively speaking, who are paying the tax, who have many of those benefits that the vast poor do not, even for us, there's a diminution in our dignity because we have less and less control over our ability to make a difference and to help our fellow South African make a difference. And, and there's something, I think, that we haven't perhaps vocalized, but is part very much of that conversation and explains the anger, the sense of, okay, well, we can afford rates and taxes, but it's not just that we're not getting anything for it. Nobody's getting anything for it. And we understand the need for some people to be more reliant on what the government provide than from our money than we get for our taxation.
I mean, that's something we're seeing very strongly at the moment in Johannesburg, where I think the ratepayers are up in arms. They're really fed up because the city has just published the increases in the various levies and rates that residents are expected to pay. And residents rightly say, well, we're not getting service for it. You know, we've got days long electricity outages. We've got days long water outages. We've got potholes in the streets. We've got streetlights that don't work. And we do realize that our rates are designed to help people in other parts of the city as well, who might not be as fortunate as we are. But if nobody's getting any benefit from what we are paying, then what is the point of paying it? And that, I think, is really one of the drivers of this unhappiness, which from the government's point of view is quite a dangerous thing. We looked at the maths recently, and we saw that there's only about 864,000 personal income taxpayers in South Africa who earn over 750,000 rand per year, which is, you know, not a terribly high threshold, and who contribute, if memory serves, 58% of personal income tax. So it's quite a big number. And if you think of this group of people, 800,000 people, these are the people who've got the skills, the education, the work experience to have a good chance of making it overseas. Mm. So if you as the government are really annoying these people and doing your best to chase them away with your policies, then you're going to have a big hole in your finances soon. And that is, I think, something, again, that the Treasury is aware of. They know that this is a risk, and they're worried about it. But I think the rest of the government hasn't quite realized it, that as much as they may feel that they're on the driving seat, they are actually in a position of dependence on the taxpayers. And the taxpayers also don't know this yet. But if your policy as a government is to say we're going to fix the public finances by chasing away the taxpayers, you're going to have a problem. Similarly, with company corporate income tax, it's similar. There's about 840 companies or thereabouts that earn over 100 million per year. It's a very small number of companies, and that pay about three quarters of corporate income tax. And again, if you're the government and you're making life hard for these companies, will they want to invest in South Africa? Or are they going to say, well, it's time to look for offshore opportunities. It's time to diversify our risk. It's time to list on another stock exchange, as we've been seeing from the companies. This is what's happening already. And it's from the government's point of view, once again, really very, very dangerous game to be playing.
Well, being the IRR, we're never backward in coming forward with suggestions as to how, what needs to be done and how it should be done. And I leave it to you to start the ball rolling on what it is it actually involves in order to achieve that growth. What are some of the fundamentals that we should be aiming at, or any government whose policy should be directed towards?
Well, we also spoke about the mood in the country in preparing for this show. And we all know that the mood isn't great. And, you know, people are really worried, obviously, about how things are. But our sense is that it actually wouldn't take that much to really change the course that we're on very dramatically. You'll see that many of the manifestos from the political parties talk about spending large amounts of money to get the country right and, you know, massive investment in infrastructure and black industrialists and what have you, many state programs that cost billions in order to fix the economy. But that's actually not what it takes. So in our view, you can do it for relatively little money and you can do it in a relatively simple way. And to encapsulate it in a single phrase, it would be to say, you just have to take off the brakes. At the moment, you know, the government is applying the brakes to the economy all over the place because it is trying to achieve certain social engineering outcomes that it's not achieving. It's making things worse. But the worse things get, the more it interferes in order to fix what it has broken before. And really what needs to happen is take the brakes off and let the economy grow and, you know, get out of the way. And in concrete terms, to name one example, one of the things you need to get growth is investment. So you need people to spend their money in South Africa. It would be great if they would spend the money not only on buying stocks and bonds, but also if they would, you know, build one or other factory or build a port or a railway. And we call that kind of investment fixed investment. Mm-hmm. So fixed investment is really important for the economy of your country. The world average rate of gross fixed capital formation is 26% of GDP. In South Africa, we're sitting at 14%. So what this shows us is that we're not building the factories and the roads and the infrastructure that we need to make goods and then to ship goods to market. And what it also shows us is that the investors do not have the confidence in South Africa to put their money here. And we think this is not because they, you know, are hostile towards South Africa or anything like that. They're also not motivated by racism. You know, I think any capitalist worth his name is going to be more motivated by making money than by any such simple thing as racism. So give the investors the opportunity to invest. And if you want to do that, one of the things you have to do is stop messing with property rights. So our government, you know, is pursuing as we speak the ability to conduct expropriation without compensation of land. And if you're an overseas investor, you know, just hearing that is going to put you off immediately. Then they'll hear something about prescribed assets where the government wants to dictate to pension funds that they have to invest a certain share of their assets in state infrastructure projects, for example, where the government might even guarantee a return. But if you know that they control the printing presses, then you'll be worried about the value of the return that they're guaranteeing you. So this is, you know, prescribed assets is actually another attack on private property rights. National health insurance is another such attack. If you think of the way in which 16% of the population approximately are paying for public health system through their taxes, and then they're taking their much diminished income after taxes and they're spending more money still on private healthcare, and the government wants to eliminate that option from people. And once again, you know, the group that is going to be most affected by that is going to be the people paying the taxes, earning over 750,000 rand per year, with the ability to go overseas. So this is like a really, really bad idea. Mm-hmm. But yeah, taking the brakes off, in short, is what we need to do. Stop messing with property rights, make it a lot easier for investors to come into the country, and also for local investors to deploy their capital, knowing that it's going to be safe. It's not going to be taken, seized by the government. And as a corollary, also it will not be taken by criminals. So you do actually need to fix the police, if you want investors to flock here. Mm.
Well, that point came up in an article in the Daily Friend, in which the author described crime as the big issue. And I would say that the crime, dreadful as the impact is on society, solving crime cannot be done without growth, and with all the security that not having to submit to a life of crime offers. So in other words, you know, if you start to make an impact on all those issues like growth that affect people positively, you'll be able more easily to have an effect on horrific rates of crime. So it's not a case, nothing is in isolation from anything else. Everything, or the improvement of everything, depends on the improvement of everything else.
Exactly. And the way I like to think about this is that, you know, if you accept the primacy of economic growth as your policy target, that would actually impose some really valuable disciplines on your policy portfolio. And crime is one example where you might say, okay, I'll focus on economic growth, we'll ignore law enforcement until you realize that you need the discipline of proper law enforcement in order to get the economic growth. So you'll realize that you have to fix that. Mm-hmm. Another example would be maintenance on infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We'll say it's not really a sexy thing to do. It's expensive. Like nobody, you know, respects you for it or rewards you for it. But if you've decided that you want economic growth, then you know you've got to do the maintenance. So the discipline comes as a result of that focus. And I think that's quite a valuable thing to have.
Is there an element of within the ANC, it's perhaps very largely because of ideological reasons, that it might fear or be wary of the individual person's own agency, their ability to do things for yourself and need the government just for the fundamentals to get ahead? Because the government, you know, they may speak a good game about 2 million jobs. I think Cyril Ramaphosa has promised this every year since he came into office, that, you know, they're going to provide jobs. And they provide these really sad, often temporary, very low-level jobs. Nothing has the permanence that allows people to get onto a rung on the ladder and then go upward. That is much more in the hands of the private sector. And if you don't give that space to the private sector, you're not – you're always going to be providing a bit, but not very much.
Mm. I think there are two aspects to this. The one is that the ANC's mindset, I think, is very much one that sees the state as being at the center of the economy. And therefore, it sees the need, for example, to provide not even jobs, but what they call job opportunities, yes, which are these, as you say, sad, you know, sad sort of opportunities for people to do a bit of work, but not a proper job, ultimately. And I think the second motivator here is that what we advocate for is quite scary in a way. So, you know, we're very much in favor of freedom, individual freedom, a minimum of coercion. And what that means is that you maybe can't be confident of the outcome. Right. So if you're a kind of nervous and anxious government person who's worried about unemployment, you've got one person telling you, well, you know, the government has to create jobs. You need presidential employment services and youth employment services and expanded public works programs and what have you to create jobs, because then you know it's going to work. You can count the number of jobs you created. And you've got another person saying, well, just take the brakes off the economy. Just let people get on with it, and then you'll get lots of jobs as a result. And you, you know, rightfully might then say, but how do I know this is going to work? This makes me very nervous. You know, I can't give people that much freedom. They might not do what I want them to do.
But in fact, the reality, and I'm not sure if the government entirely understands this, is to a large extent what keeps society afloat and from disintegrating into a sort of lawless mass, is the very fact that people, despite the limitations, in every sense of the word, we have a significant informal economy. In other words, people going out and finding opportunities. They may not be sort of sophisticated and huge opportunities, but they are opportunities that keep, they put bread on the table and provide a service to or goods to other people. And that's been going on, that's agency, that's been going on despite the government, despite the governments, all the governments we've ever had.
I think that's a really great example, and you're absolutely right about that. And it's an expression of the fact that people, you know, do want to freely engage in commercial exchange to the benefit of both parties engaged in the trade, which is how it should be in a free market economy. And when the government tries to crack down and, you know, impose more regulations and intervene more in the economy to achieve its outcomes that it's looking for, it does actually drive more and more people into the informal economy. And maybe that is another hopeful aspect of our situation, which is that the government is becoming less and less capable of enforcing its authority. We made much of that in a speech last year in the United States, which we call the weakening of the detrimental state. So for the past 15 years, the government really has played a detrimental role in South Africa. It has harmed the growth prospects, the economic prospects, the social cohesion, like everything's been pretty bad over the last 15 years. But the ability of the state to keep playing that detrimental role is receding fast. We can see people increasingly ignoring the state and going and doing their own thing. You know, you provide your own power, you fix the potholes in your area, you ignore e-tolls because, you know, you don't believe that it was a good system, and you get on with your life. And I think we're going to see more and more of that in the next few years, especially if the government persists in standing in the way of people trying to get ahead in their lives, you know, and making their own lives better.
So in effect, it's the people are leaving the government behind.
Yes.
Rather thought is the fact that, you know, you often have in the sort of lofty speeches of our cabinet ministers and our president, the desire for unity. And first of all, I think just personally, unity is an overrated concept. And B, we actually are incredibly unified. We are all very unhappy with the way the government treats us.
Yes.
And if anything has created a unity, it is that. It's almost like, you know what it's like when you stand in a queue.
Yes.
Waiting to get into Home Affairs. And it doesn't matter what status in life you come from. Mm-hmm. If you start chatting to the people on either side of you, whatever their color, whatever their status, you will find that you all have the same things to complain about. And that's,
yes.
And that's really where unity can be found. Just the last question, and that is, what is your sense of where big business is at in its relationship with government, particularly given the big the sort of social compact of mid-2023, when the business essentially went to government and said, look, we offer help. They delineated specific areas to deal with, including, for example, crime and infrastructure, particularly ports and railways. We've heard the president say that, you know, things are going swimmingly, but we haven't really heard from the people who promised to report back to us, which is big business.
Yeah, I do think that the unity of mind between the government and big business is beginning to crack. I don't think that they quite see eye to eye anymore as often as they used to.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that, of course, is that business is seeing its economic opportunities declining because of government incompetence and underperformance. And over time, I do think that we're going to see business play a more and more assertive role. Some companies have started doing that already. Others are taking a bit longer to get to that point. And that is ultimately a good thing. You know, you do want, I think, business to, again, impose some discipline on a government that is often very ill-disciplined.
You'd agree with me if I say that the one thing about South Africa, it will always be a challenging environment to live in and to work in. But South Africans have a capacity to grab the nettle in a way that perhaps a lot of other societies don't. And therein may lie hope.
Absolutely. You know, it may very well be that we as people living in South Africa are living in what will be the future for much of the rest of the world. You know, we I think have reached a level of distrust in our government that other countries may get to in due course. I think we've realized that we need to take responsibility for our own lives, our neighborhoods, our communities, to an extent that other countries do not, where people still are very reliant on the government. Now, if you live in one of the welfare states in Europe, you rely on the government for your pension, for your infrastructure. You know, everything will be taken care of until it isn't. And in South Africa, we're at the opposite end of the spectrum. Like, nothing is being taken care of, so you've got to do it. And we are doing it. And I think it's one of the great strengths of South Africa that we're doing that.
I think perhaps you can create an economic theory that goes on that when you have nothing else to lose, the only way is up.
Exactly. And yeah, and as I said, we only have to take the brakes off and we'll be flying.
Yes, that does bring to mind some certain images that we may not want to think about. But John, thank you very much for coming on and telling us why we need to have faith in ourselves.
Thank you very much, Sarah.